Great to be giving an introduction today, but I was asked to, so I will. And during the lunch break, I've had 15 minutes preparation, so bear that in mind. To continue from the early part of the discussion, definitions are very important. Recessions and depressions are different animals, and therefore it's important to define what is the distinction between those two, particularly if you're a Marxist, in the sense that you are as trading that you know what's going on in the world. If you do not know what's going on in the world, you cannot be a Marxist. Even if you're just a serious thinker, you do have to know. So therefore, defining the nature of things is absolutely vital. It's not enough. Now, we may argue whether this is a depression or not, but it is not enough to abdicate the question of definitions. Neither is it serious to adopt stopgap definitions like a deep recession or a recession of a special kind. That's the usual Trotskyist thing, isn't it, to define things as a special kind. Because what is the theoretical underpinning of such a term? Well, it's no better than the abdication that you've made in relation to defining what is a depression or defining what is a recession. So you do have to take the material seriously. Second thing, I think the figures are important. You cannot ignore the figures, because there's that old Marxist piece of wisdom that the accumulation of quantitative factors can lead to a qualitative change. And I think that in this depression, that is a factor that's important. The size of things does matter in what's going on. It limits the options. It limits the strategic abilities of each one of the players or which one of the nations in this country, in the depression. What I wanted to do is really divide into two sections. What I wanted to do, one is to talk about the depression of the 30s, because it is full of errors. People's view, it's very, very coloured with the 1930s, a lot of mythologies. I wish, they wouldn't put that book by Galbraith on the shelf, because it's just full of errors. It was not like that. That's not what really happened. And the reason I insist upon that is because I think this is actually the first depression, the first systemic real depression of capitalism, and the 1930s, apart from America, was not really a depression, and we have to understand it. Although there are elements that can be actually conceptually quite interesting. Most of what happened during the 1930s, and as I said before, happened actually in a small corner of the world economy, because it didn't affect everybody, was really the product of the unresolved nature, financial nature of the First World War. Essentially, although people thought that the war was going to be very different in the sense that it was a mechanized war, they actually got themselves far more indebted than they thought. The war lasted a lot longer, and they had to, most advanced capitalist countries except the United States, got themselves mortgaged to be able to defeat their opponent, got themselves mortgaged. Particularly Britain, which at that time was the banker to the world, the financial centre of the world, to keep its allies in the war, had to extend very large credits to them, and also had to extend very large funds to other countries to keep them neutral, like Sweden. Sweden didn't like the idea of having an embargo on its goods imposed. So, and one of the strategies that the British and the French used to defeat Germany was to impose an economic embargo. As a result, Britain mortgaged its financial future. It had to borrow very, very heavily from the United States. And at the end of the war, what we have is the banker of the world is a net debtor. Now, being the central banker of the world gives you a great deal of privileges. But one thing you cannot escape is a capital requirement. If you're broke, essentially, you cannot really be the guarantor of world financial relations. And what we have is a massive crisis, massive financial crisis, which the British tried to overcome, but were not able to. In fact, the problem for Britain at that point, and I make an emphasis on this because there are lessons for today, she was in a very, very particular position because she owed a tremendous amount of money to the United States, who insisted on repayment, but Britain had extended funds to other countries who she could not bully for repayment because they were her customers and because these countries simply couldn't pay. In other words, Britain in that situation was in a double bind. And this introduced a massive weakness at the centre of European finances. The second aspect very, very crucial during the interwar period is the attempt to make Germany pay for the Second World, for the First World War. Now, you know, the economic consequences of the Versailles Treaty are well known, so I won't rehearse them. But one thing that it did is the country that could have pulled Europe out, like an engineering piece of like a locomotive, was Germany. And the fact that it basically broke its economy by attempting to get it to pay a level of war debt it could not sustain introduced another weakness. Nothing to do with the systemic capital. And neither of the factors, rather, are to do with the systemic crisis of capitalism. They were contingent problems, unresolved problems from the First World War. Thirdly, agricultural prices plummeted. Very ignored aspect. When there's a war on, essentially, First World War was fought by peasants. Take labour off the land, put them into trenches, etc., which means that the price of labour goes up because there's not the hands available. Countries that are not in the war, they start production massively because they're producing food for countries that are involved in war and cannot produce food. Almost every country, particularly also the United States, engaged in this. There is a post-war boom in commodities which signals, gives the entirely wrong signal to the European economy that these prices are going to stay. What happened is that a lot of people bought into, just like the subprime mortgage, bought into a lot of agricultural land, marginal agricultural land, to be able to meet this production. When, from 1922 onwards, production is resumed in much of Europe, these prices started to collapse and collapse massively. Essentially, from Eastern Europe, 1922 onwards, certainly from the summer of 1923, prices start to collapse in Eastern Europe and move westward. Remember that at that time, the economy of these countries was very, very heavily on agriculture. So what you have, again, nothing to do with the systemic nature of capitalism, very much to do with the disruptions of the First World War. Only in America do you have a classical boom-bust cycle, something that you'd recognise from reading Marx's Capital. You have a boom during the 1920s, it goes bust, and then you have a depression. I would say that actually, had it not been for the massive crisis, stagnation there was in the European economy, it could have been possible actually to avoid the depression of the 1930s, because with only one country having had a boom and going bust, that could have been solved internationally. But the fact that that occurred at a time when the European economy is very, very stagnant in critical conditions, meant that actually the world went into crisis. Now, it's a very different interpretation. The normal interpretation of the 1930s is that you get a stock market crash. 1929, the American economy goes into depression, and the depression spreads along the world. Well, it didn't happen like that. It didn't spread along the world. There was already stagnation in most of the European economies long before the Wall Street crash. And therefore, when people start talking about intervention at any time, do this, do that, really, they don't understand the 1930s. They don't understand there are a whole series of problems. Before I move on, just to make one point, you could have solved the indebtedness between countries, and you could have solved even the decline in agricultural prices in Europe at the time by financial means. Any level of debt, you can securitize it. You can turn it into paper for 30 years, 60 years, 90 years, bear interest on it, and, as it were, you can kick it into the evolutionary distance. So it on figures by themselves, or mathematically, there is a way out of almost any crisis. The problem is that, obviously, the economy is not run by mathematicians or even economists. It belongs to different countries, and therefore, resolving a crisis with huge amounts, requires political decisions between countries. And therefore, a crisis that is theoretically possible, if the numbers are large enough, is politically impossible to sort out, because there are too many rivalries, there are too many problems in a world economic system to actually solve a crisis that economically could be solved. And I think we're in the very same situation today. The crisis that we have today, even given the massive figures, it can be written down, there are theoretical ways to do that, but it's running up against some very, very important limitations, and particularly because this crisis comes at a time of the decline and the breakup of the Anglo, what I would call the Anglosphere, which is roughly Anglo-American capitalism in New Zealand, Australia. We are seeing the breakup of that political system and the financial system that represented. And therefore, it's going to be very, very difficult to find a political solution to the crisis, which is why I think actually this is the big one. Not because of there's some kind of, I've identified some process within the workings of capitalism that means that it cannot recover. Capitalism can always recover. But because there are definite political limits to solving the situation in a way that doesn't mean disruption and war. I should say that I don't believe in the question of collapse. I think there are other alternatives to collapse. They can simply grind the system down over a 5-year period. It doesn't fall like a house falls, but you get the same thing in the end. Today, I think we are in a very different situation from the 1930s. The falling rate of profit, I agree with you that the falling rate of profit cannot today be cannot be proved empirically. They don't collect the numbers in that way. And since the rise of imperialism, remember that the falling rate of profit does not refer to the organic composition in one firm. The capitalist accumulates on the basis of a part of his capital of the total social capital. Now, if that total social capital is now a world capital, and there is no part of any capital in the world that isn't in some way interlocked into that system, and what I'm talking about, that's in Asperger's term, but what I'm talking about, an American company that used to be an electronic or computer company, suddenly, sacks everybody, has 15 people who are designers, 3 people who are in financial control. What it does is gets its components made in Malaysia, the components of it, and then shipped to China, then they're shipped to the American market. Now, where is the surplus value there? Which surplus value or which organic composition? It's evidently there because the goods are produced and it's produced by workers. But you've got to calculate, to be able to calculate the falling rate of profit in relation to even a sector, let alone a company, you would have to calculate the falling rate of profit in Malaysia, in China, impossible to do, and then find out how a particular company is accumulating in relation to the American market, let alone the fact that that company may also be engaging, accumulating profits on the basis of also having money in playing in Wall Street, because as has been mentioned, most companies do have a financial mix, and not only production, but from other investments. Then, let alone considerations of taxation, etc., etc. But nevertheless, that is the backdrop. And I think it's generally recognised in the West that in the United States, in the advanced capitalist countries, there has been a decline in return or a decline in profitability from production. I would go as far as to say in the United States in the last 20 years, it's impossible really. So it's not worth having a firm unless 2 things. One is you're big enough to actually corner one area of the market. In other words, what you're doing and reaping is monopoly profits. I use the term monopoly there in the restrictive trade sense, not in the sense that Lenin used it. Or you are small enough, you have a niche, a local niche, which means that you are really protected from prices, world prices. In other words, you don't really produce on the world market. What you produce is something locally. They don't, people don't mind paying £3 rather than £2.50 for coffee or for a hair for a haircut. Those, if you look at the majority of 5 minutes of capitalist concerns in the United States, they fall into those. Most of the profits made in the United States is actually in relation either to external sources of surplus value or through the mediation of finance, really a transfer of surplus value from other countries. So that's mitigated. Now, what has happened, of course, that it doesn't work that way. You don't have this falling rate of profit. It sort of declines, and at this point, you get collapse or whatever. The state is there. A country experiencing those factors, by definition, has already accumulated a large amount of money, and that allows that accumulation of money to play the markets to play the financial markets and make and absorb surplus value and profits from other countries, and in the final stages of that, to make money out of money. And I think that's what's happened in America. My definition of a depression, therefore, is two things. It really is related to two things. One is that you have a long period where crisis has been apparent and has been postponed. Recessions have been postponed by government intervention, allowing the system to continue, but accumulating imbalances until there comes a time that it collapses or it becomes unviable. And the problem there is that the accumulation of problems is such that it doesn't allow the spontaneous mechanism of the business cycle to recover. In other words, that falling prices never reach that point where they entice capitalists back into production, where pouring in, well, the government pouring in large amounts of funds into the economy doesn't entice capitalists to come back into production. And that's clear, I think, where we are now. The second... and that brings me to the second aspect, which is the normal mechanisms of recovery have no effect. You know, if you pour billions of pounds into it, you should get some sort of turnaround. But you notice that in this crisis, it's been almost a year, we don't even have green shoots. The last time, I think it was three weeks ago, somebody mentioned green shoots, and they were slammed down. It's a admission that actually has no effect whatsoever. I think the Treasury almost now accepts that its first round of bailouts has had no effect on the economy whatsoever. Just what I want to emphasise before I finish, this thing about collapse. We shouldn't, as Marxists or even as not Marxists, looking for the collapse, you know, when the house... It may happen that way. It may well happen that way. And the fact that this is Britain and the heartland of the imperialist country, I admit... that the world ruining class will be very cautious before a country like this goes down. They may not have options. Right? The dimensions of the crisis are such that if you don't want the UK to go down, you're going to have to pay a very large price for it. Are other countries willing to do that? Because that's the only way to solve it. Britain actually is like Iceland. It is already bankrupt. The trouble is no one has made the call yet because they think it might solve itself. Finally, I would say, just like my point that came up quite a lot in the previous section, is that's the use of the word parasite. One of the foundations of Marxism is that you explain the workings of capitalism within the theory. You do not use an external element like a parasite to explain the crisis. I think this is the wrong thing because it leads to the kind of populist explanation of the crisis based on some illegitimate part of capitalism or some illegitimate player that comes in and feeds off legitimate capitalism or things. That's not. There is nobody who's here who's parasitic. Everybody's been involved in this crisis. Everything. And on this occasion, actually, quite truly, through your houses, quite a lot of people in this room will have also been playing this casino capitalism. So it's not a question of the evil banker, etc. That's the most visible aspect of it, but it entails everybody.
Okay, all right. So we can just go right into the discussion, and then, unless you want to say something first?
Yeah.
Yes?
Well,
let's see what can I get an indication? People who want to speak? All right, okay, so let's take people who haven't spoken first. So, one more time, the hands. Okay, one and two, and then. You've already spoken. What? Yeah, I've got that. I've got Ben. Ben, is it? Yes.
No,
John. John, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll blame it on my jet lag. Okay, go ahead.
My name is Jim Smith. The first, I think this expression of falling rate of profit, I think can see its manifestations in much of what we discussed. I mean, I was a retardant to making profits through banks, through finance capital, except that it wasn't profitable to invest in industry. I think it does come from that. What, fictitious capital or investment, as someone said, on mortgaging on hopefully future produced values, it is not producing value, and therefore the values are not actually produced. It matches capital clearly. There is a crisis going to come. There is credit extended that's not being mapped very well, is produced. And so, I mean, I think we can see that. I think that's also an aspect of something that Fried Mike Hudson used, was privatization of government. I mean, looking at the banks in particular, that I think privatization of government has been happening in this country and in the United States, and in fact, most capitalist countries for some time, that previously state functions have been privatized. And this is usually done in the name of efficiency. Right? I think a major reason, it's generally been very inefficient. You have an army that monitors how to look for whether the contractors do what they're supposed to do and so on. What it does do, so is again give a kind of artificial method by which capitalists can invest money profitably by investing these government contracts, with the benefit that they're kind of underwritten, the risk is underwritten by central government. I think all of these are manifestations of this tendency. It is only a tendency in capital towards falling rate of profit, but obviously, yes, it's, as has been said, it's difficult to demonstrate that empirically. I think the other thing we do have to look at is the response of the working class. And, you know, some people have said there are different possible responses. And I mean, I think in this country, you know, both perhaps the possibilities and the dangers have been shown in this recent strike of the refinery workers. And certainly, I mean, on the face of it, they're using a very reactionary slogan, although one that was, in fact, invented by Gordon Brown himself, British jobs for British workers, an attack on on Italian and Portuguese workers. Certainly potential for very reactionary politics. The British National Party is getting itself involved. At the same time, I don't think it's quite good enough, really, to say that, put it the way Nick Cox did, this is a trade union movement being reactionary. I mean, first, in fact, the official leadership, they certainly don't like the solidarity action in Scotland, the British threatened their salaries and so on. And I mean, what we have to do, I think, obviously, you know, is to recognise working classes in the capitalist countries, the most capitalist countries. If there's not an internationalist and socialist leadership, then you know, a lot of workers will probably turn to protectionist nationalists and perhaps even fascist politics. But you know, I think it's sort of wrong to blame the workers for it. So we really have to say that, you know, the necessity is to build a Marxist leadership now. I know some people in this room were committed to a campaign for a Marxist party, but unfortunately that doesn't seem to have quite taken off. But I mean, the principle of that is something that we have to do, is build an international party in the working class that can actually provide a leadership to workers. You know, I think this is being shown as being absolutely necessary by what's happening. You know, otherwise, even militant working class action may be misled in a reactionary direction.
Okay.
John Bridge.
Yeah, I'm not at all convinced about your thesis that this is the one, this is the systemic crisis. I mean, it would strike me that if you want to actually explain World War One, if you want to explain the 20th century, you've got to go back, I would have said, to the systemic crisis of capitalism in that sense, i.e. the turn to imperialism, finance, capital, in the late 19th century. In that sense, surely what we need to be doing is recognising, yes, we're at a new stage. Quite clearly, we're dealing not only with, in that sense, the long-term decline of capitalism, but that is also linked in the 20th century, the decline of British capitalism, but also now the decline of American capitalism, relative decline of American capitalism. I'm not also convinced about the idea that parasitism, although by definition it's sort of outside, is a non-Marxist category, or you know, external to the system. It strikes me as fundamental to the actual workings of the capitalist system. So the question is, if we look at the present crisis, we could look at the present crisis, I would suggest, either as some sort of, capitalism has its ups and downs, it's always had its ups and downs, therefore we don't know quite how far it's going to go down, but we sort of know it's going to go up, isn't really the right way of looking at it, because surely we need to look at it in terms of declining forms of capitalism itself. And if we look at where we are today, we're, how should you put it, I don't know whether you want to get into a grand numbering systems, but if you look at Bretton Woods, that was both an attempt to restore money, but a failure to restore money. It was just limited to the dollar. If you look at the breakdown of Bretton Woods, quite clearly something major was going on with that system. If you look at what's going on now, something again is major is going on with the system. I quite agree that the system that certainly was put in place from the 70s, that is quite clearly broken down. We're not only dealing in that sense with an economic crisis of capitalism. I would have thought, from our point of view, from the point of view of Marxists, just as important, or maybe even more important than that, what we're dealing with is a breakdown of their ideology. To me, that's absolutely fundamental, because certainly in Britain, we've been sold privatisation, we've been sold capitalism, we've been sold the idea there is no alternative, Tina. And I think that, precisely as Jim, isn't it, you know, has raised up, you know, when you look around the world today, it's quite clear, by their own admission, that capitalism has failed. You know, when you get, you know, you quote Greenspan and all the other leaders of the capitalist class, and you look at the Financial Times, no one can turn around now and say the system works, the system's functioning. The real question is, what's the alternative? I mean, it's not there is no longer an alternative. You know what? There must be an alternative or something like that.
Another world is possible.
It doesn't quite scan, does it? But you get the general idea. And if you look at just this week's politics, and I know it's very easy to get carried away in this week's politics, but I mean, in terms of recent events, yes, Susie, you referred to it, the Greek events. You talked about the French strikes. In Britain, you've got workers going around with British jobs for British workers. I don't think Gordon Brown invented it, but I get your point. Yes, exactly. They're quoting it quite consciously.
Yeah, working class invented it.
Whoever invented it, I'm sure it's got a history that goes back at least to the 19th century, actually. But anyway, the point is that, yes, these are the first manifestations, very incoherent manifestations, of some sort of political response. But the question is, I mean, you pose the question, you instantly get the answer, is it anywhere adequate? And the instant you pose that, you get the blinding, shouting answer back, no, it damn well isn't. And I think that is where we come back to, that as well as discussing, I think it's absolutely essential that we discuss the crisis. Where does it come from? How deep we think it is? Where it needs to be located in history? But while I don't agree, I mean, it depends how you define collapse exactly, how you define these things. The real question is that only the working class can positively bring this system to an end. And that is the big question that we face. Because in a certain sense, I mean, I think Mike, you referred to it, didn't you, in your contribution this morning. On one level, you could look at us, and we're back to square one. And I think there's a certain truth to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. There, and then Mike.
There's an interesting book written some years ago by Kanan Hopkins, I can't quite remember, it's about British industrialisation. And they make this useful point that whereas Britain had been called the workshop of the world, actually most of its money came from being the warehouse of the world. And because of all the financial, commercial, shipping services and everything else, that from basically the late 1800s, certainly into the turn of the century. And I think what's, and this is part of the point I was trying to make earlier on about, you know, there is not such a big distinction between sort of industry and finance and all the rest of it. Because what you find, according to the position of an economy and in the global system, especially in a imperialist power like Britain, it will evolve in whatever way kind of makes sense for it. And essentially, the development of the British economy into more of a financial sphere, with all the previous imperial connections and the current imperial connections, and what that's done, I think, is on the one hand give a real character to British foreign policy, you know, and it's no surprise that, you know, Britain backs up American policy and is actually more aggressive than America in all kinds of things that it does, but it does it in a more smarmy diplomatic way than the Americans have been able to do so far. And it also has an impact on the, you know, the character of the working class in Britain as well. And I think we're seeing that in, you know, this reactionary stuff on fighting for jobs. There's not an ounce of positive things in that I can see at all. And the second point I want to make, kind of related to this, is that what we've had in Britain, at least, is, you know, best part of 20 years, more or less continuous growth, about 1991-ish to, say, 2007-ish. And it's interesting to try and pin down a couple of historical factors behind it, because remember the discussion of falling rate of profit and everything, which, you know, is certainly an important factor. You need to kind of put it in historical context. And clearly what we've had has been two quite critical changes in the global economy from the point of view of drawing in, say, Chinese workers and Indian workers and from many low-wage countries. And even in Europe, the expansion of the European Union and the EC, the EU, whatever you want to call it, into Eastern Europe has been dramatic as well. So we've had a mixture then of cheap Polish farmers and cheap Chinese T-shirts and cheap Chinese electronic goods. And all of this stuff helped keep inflation low, helped keep profitability ticking over, kept the capitalist economy ticking over, and was quite an important momentum, I think, behind the speculative boom that got going, because it looked like, you know, things are growing all the time. Well, of course, if I take on more debt, it doesn't really matter. Right? I've still got a job, things are fine. And what we now find, however, is that the positive impacts of taking on zillions of cheap labour in many countries has, like, come to an end. And it's like, you know, where's the next trick going to come from? And I think that's the real critical point now, because it's a case of having a huge amount of debt, and it's then a case, politically, of who pays the bill or who takes the loss. And I think that's really a recipe for big clashes between different countries and, you know, grabbing influence and all kinds of nationalistic moves and everything that we're going to be seeing in the coming years.
Okay, just, Mike, before, I just wanted to ask a few questions, too. You know, just I'm really surprised I hadn't heard Jim mention the British jobs for British workers. So was that the demand? Because in the U.S., that's failed. You know, we're not seeing that kind of nationalistic response. The Republicans tried really hard in the last several years to bring up the immigrant labor question. And in fact, there was no real interest in it. It was mostly the product of Sensenbrenner and a bunch of other northern politicians who were playing to their constituencies. But in the huge part of the country where you have massive numbers of immigrant workers, it didn't play. And of course, they've been affected by the crisis far worse than let's say the native working class has. Last month alone, in December, not January, in December in California, 30,000 Mexicans went home because they couldn't get work, and the remittances are down by 12%. I think Hillel mentioned to me privately that something similar is happening in Poland now as Polish workers go home, and remittances aren't going home. And I think it's an area that needs to be explored. And just on Sousa's point about the stimulus hasn't worked and that Obama's this remedy is a failure, I think it's too early to say. I think that it's right to say that the stimulus isn't large enough yet. But it hasn't been tried. I mean, they're barely getting it through the Congress in the United States. Bush didn't try that kind of a stimulus. He just gave back, you know, he gave a minimal tax relief to everybody, a $300 check, which immediately went to paying off bills and had no effect whatsoever. But I think it's too early to say that. And I say that in the absence of any generalized working class response, that capitalists are trying to come up with something that will prolong the situation. And I don't think we can rule out that they might get up to even that 40% one way or another to try to ameliorate the crisis. The last thing before, and I would like Hillel to address, he brought up in the last session what happened in 1998 in Russia. And, you know, it's far worse than almost anyone in the West realized, I think, that the army was telling its soldiers to forage for mushrooms in the forest because they couldn't pay them. Barter took, was 80% of transactions. for the most part, in the economy. When I was there in the summer of 1999, people were hoarding rice under their beds and growing potatoes in pots in the windows. And that's because you can say you can't go back to subsistence agriculture, but don't forget that this is an urban educated population for the most part. So it's very, very different from, you know, what happened earlier on. And I think that that's right. We need to consider that. And in the U.S., there's real hunger right now. The situation is absolutely dramatic. And for anyone who hasn't been to the United States in even 1 year, come to the United States and just see how drastic and stunning it is in this very short amount of time. Homelessness and hunger and desperation.
And middle-class people.
Middle-class people, it's just absolutely, I have no other word to use except stunning. To just watch it going on. What's that? Yeah, we'll give them all shovel-ready jobs, as they say. Which, by the way, the feminists are already saying that this is discriminating against women because it's only going to give employment to men, and that the stimulus has to be also for women in the fields of healthcare and education. And in fact, Obama has started to address that because it's a very important constituency. Okay, Mike.
I agree with John on the point about the World War One itself comes from the inner dynamics of capitalism. Okay. And one level further down on that, why does it do so? The answer is because in order to have credit money on a scale larger than the sort of family networks which operate credit money in the Middle Ages, in small closed networks of traders, you have to have the state. Credit money is the credit money of the state. It is not the case that the bourgeoisie's credit money is autonomous from state enforcement of debts. Yeah? And international credit money, the existence of the reserve currency, depends, therefore, on the existence of a world hegemon power. Yeah? Britain is the ultimate guarantor in the 19th century, even though it's gold, technically gold transactions. The actual guarantor of credit, global credit transactions, is the British Navy. And the reality after 1945, the ultimate guarantor of credit transactions is the US Armed Forces. Yeah? It's for that reason that you have a world hegemon power in the capitalist system. And it's for that reason that the decline of a world hegemon power necessarily produces massive disruption in the functionality of the economy gradually over a period of time, etc. The other thing, nobody can say the system's working. True, nobody can say the system's working, but the sort of Austrian types are saying, well, the reason why the system's broke is because we have had all this state intervention to stop things going bust when they ought to have been allowed to go bust, which in a sense is actually true. Yeah? There is a sense in which it's genuinely true that the subprime crisis is produced by the Clinton administration's instructions in relation to easing credit criteria in order to enable poor people to get on the housing ladder. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's only in a very limited sense, because the flip side of it is, suppose you actually go down the road of the Austrians. The Austrians' arguments actually presuppose that the quantity of land is unlimited, and that the working day can go up to 24 hours and stuff like that. That there aren't limits which are expressed, the physical limits which are expressed in the labour theory of value and in the theories of rent. Yeah. So that in reality, actually, if you follow the Austrians' line, the state would let everything go bust, and you let the people who happen to have cash buy up, and you replace freehold mortgage with rental tenure across the UK and the US, the speed with which the government would lose political legitimacy and authority and would be unable to get its soldiers and policemen to do what it wanted would be extraordinary. You know, so the in that sense, no one can say the system's working. It is true that there are people who can say the system's working. It's just the political irrealism of saying the problem is the interference with capitalism rather than the problem is capitalism itself.
Okay, we have two more. Matthew and then... Okay, and then I think we'll take it back to the panel.
I just think in terms of the working class response, I mean, it is
obviously a start, you know, in terms of you've got, you know, first of all, obviously, the weakest point, you have an explosion in Greece, you have then a big upsurge in France, as you would expect, with a class-conscious class. It's interesting that Susie's saying, you know, there's not really a spot of response at all. I mean, from American working class, I mean, you know, maybe going back to, like, the 80s when they'd be around smashing Japanese cars and all this kind of stuff, you know, that kind of...
Can I just interject?
Yeah.
You know, absolutely not, because right away, as factories were being shuttered in Chicago, the Republic window and doors workers went and occupied their factories until they were paid, you know, their... They kept it open. Well, it was minimal, but it was very, very important and symbolic.
What's interesting in Britain, actually, is that the section of the working class which is involved is, if you like, the last redoubt of the skilled manual working class in this country. And it's the bits that the ruling class has really worked hard to keep out of any form of struggle. Those are the sides. I mean, you're actually looking at quite a broad set of actions, you know, involving oil refineries, power stations, and these central, and the old ICI site in Wilton, quite strategic, absolutely strategic places, and really, I think they will be really fearful of this. I mean, despite whatever the working class, British jobs and British workers, the fact that suddenly all these sites that there's been pickets outside of them, listing has spread with the speed it has, and that things like anti-union laws and so on and so forth will be ignored. That's a straw as well. I mean, the point is, really, in terms of that, I don't know. I need to go and speak to people in the union and see what their response is within the likes of Unite in terms of, you know, they're now being portrayed as the chief sort of projection of British nationalism, which is not something they're accustomed to. The thing is that it's also the way that working class has been treated, because what you're looking at is the working is in what the ruling class has done to those workers who are overwhelmingly male is to basically remove their security of employment. So they're all contracts. They're all working for contractors. They're all working on fixed term contracts, as opposed to in most of Europe, these sort of guys would be on permanent jobs. There would be no question that any of them would ever be removed from work, or that they're on fixed terms.
But they're on contracts because they're semi-capitalists. They contract out. They bid. That's the thing. They're not ordinary workers. They're contractors.
They're gangers.
On the picket line, they're contractors and workers.
Oh, no, sure.
It's groups of workers who bid for contracts. That's what happens. It's not, you know, workers in a factory. They are actually, and the reason why we're on a flexible is because they earn a lot more money that way.
Okay. No, because also what they've done what you've had traditionally in a site like an oil refinery, particularly look at like Grangemouth. So Grangemouth used to have an entire workforce which did everything, and what they've done is they've chopped it up and said, right, you know, they're putting contractors. So the actual core workforce is now quite small, but all the jobs are done by these different contractors. So in fact, all the work, what they've done is in order to divide up the workforce, as opposed to having a single workforce, which is what exists in certainly most of Europe, and which has permanent contracts and so on, is to have this divided up into little bits. Now, obviously, that then creates a position where you do have that position where some of the workers, obviously, are then saying, well, then we're doing better because we're actually contractors, we're employing people anyway ourselves. And others of them, of course, are saying, well, you know, okay, I'm only working here for the next 12 months and then I'm off somewhere else. But the point is that's in contrast to what's happening in much of what would happen in, say, Germany or France or other parts of Europe.
It's not true. Where do these workers come from? They come from...
That's why it's originating in the form it is, because the nature of the class has been weakened more in this country than it has been in other parts. That's why it's expressing itself in the way it is. The question is, okay, you know, whether the... In terms of looking at how that sort of thing will evolve, rather than just saying, well, you know, British workers are all a bunch of terrible nationalists and all the rest of it, you know, does it move in? You know, there'll be in which direction will it move, in what way can the left actually sort of intervene into that, point out, you know, that what we're actually wanting is the issue of employment rather than the issue of nationality.
Okay, Mayor, and then we'll come back to the panel.
I wonder, Susan, if you could clarify what you meant or elaborate on what you described as the ineffectiveness of anti-foreign worker politics in the States, because there have been raids and roundups and detentions of so-called illegal workers, which goes hand in hand with the positive thing that you were talking about. So that's clearly a politics that is effective.
What I was saying is that, yeah, just very quickly, that's right, that's the Bush administration response, but it's not resonating in the American working class. There's no demand within the American working class for American jobs for American workers. And that's, you know, I was responding to the nationalism that you're seeing rear up here. You're not seeing it there. And that, and even that response, I think that, well, we don't know yet if that's going to stop, but I assume it's going to stop because it's closing down factories. It means produce is rotting in the fields and nobody will pick it, because the idea was that you round up the immigrant workers and send them home, somebody will come and take their place, and that just isn't the case.
Not at the wages of the immigrants.
What's that?
Not at the wages of the immigrants.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so let's go to the panel then. Okay. Hilla wants to start?
I agree that, of course, the depression of 1929 isn't the same as what is occurring at the moment. It's not identical, but I don't think that's enough to argue that this is the only depression. Of course, it's true, factually, you're absolutely right, that Europe was depressed, and Britain in particular was depressed. That's absolutely true, and it was... It had been, until very recently, to that period, the prime imperial power. The United States, though, was taking over. And the fact, therefore, that you had this classic form of depression in the United States doesn't mean that, therefore, we didn't have a depression which was important for the world as a whole. It's absolutely true that in Europe it had been depressed. At the same time, the 6 million unemployed by the time Hitler took over weren't simply 6 million unemployed as a result of the Versailles Treaty. The economy had turned down after 1929. The numbers of unemployed had actually shot up. So it isn't enough, therefore, just to say, well, they were depressed. It certainly got worse in that period. The overall point made by John over here is absolutely right. You can't look at any downturn, depression, recession, or whatever else you want to call it, as in a technical form. That's true. Galbraith does do that. And to that degree, you're right. Of course, he's looking at it as a radical bourgeois economist, effectively. And although he knew of Marxism, he wasn't a Marxist. That's absolutely true. Nonetheless, much of what he says there, in purely empirical terms, is actually correct of the United States. The point, it seems to me, is that what happened in the United States did determine, not wholly, but to a considerable degree, what was happening over the world economy. Now, it's true that the present time, that you're right, we now have a more globalized, it's not wholly globalized either, but a more globalized economy than was the case then. Obviously, you had the Soviet Union existing, it had its own influence, undeveloped countries of the kind you were talking about. You had the British Empire, which introduced its own form of protectionism. That's simply true, and consequently, it was different. That's true, but I don't see that, therefore, since it was different, you can say very different, that the essence of the downturn, the depression, was actually different. It's very similar to what happened, even if it's, you take America as one country, what happened in Britain in various downturns before. In that sense, Engels was right. I don't know why you have to say that when you call it a depression and then point out what was different. You could say it's more profound now, which it seems to me it actually is more profound. That's true. The interdependence is greater. It's actually, when actually it was easier for Nazi Germany to act as it is, to introduce the first Keynesian resuscitation than it would be for a country now. That's simply true. And of course, I agree with your argument that we've got an increasing demand for protectionism. That's very obvious. It's occurring at the moment through devaluation of currencies, effectively. And one could of course, project it further if the downturn continues. I agree with Susie, you can't say that the injection of resources or money into the economy has had no effect. What it hasn't done is brought the world out of the downturn or depression. But it has prevented it going the whole way further, as it were. And I think the general comments, like by the head of the IMF and various other people, or for that matter by Mervyn King, the Reserve Governor of the Bank of England, that the world faced a meltdown, or in the case of Britain, he actually thought that it was worse than 1929. I think that was the case, and to the extent that they intervened, they prevented it being like 1929. I don't see why one has to say anything else. Quite clear that has happened. That's not the same thing as saying that they've solved the crisis, or that tomorrow we're going to get out of it, or that they're prepared to go out of it fully, or whatever. And that then interrelates to this discussion of deflation. I don't see that there is a problem of inflation for the next couple of years or whatever. And the Tories' constant demand that you have to increase taxation, which is absolutely absurd, it seems to me, in case you have inflation, is crazy. When you have a deflationary impulse, which is so powerful, you can print as much money as you like. It won't make any difference. Just print the money. So, I mean, why should the capitalist class invest when it's not going to make any money? It won't. That isn't enough. It isn't enough just to print money. Keynes said that a long time ago, of course, but it's very obvious. So that isn't the issue at the moment. That isn't the issue, as it were, even if it's been raised. I think the reason why you have the right bringing up the issue is that they want to transfer it, transfer the cost to the working class. And Mike had brought up the question there as to how far the kind of classical economics. Talk to the Austrian economists were correct. Now, of course, we do have this demand, particularly in the United States, but I think probably second to the Conservative Party, and certainly among certain bourgeois economists who managed to revive bourgeois economics since the 1970s, that the economy should be allowed to go along its own course, because in that case, you get creative destruction coming from the thesis of Schumpeter and so forth. And having destroyed everything that is bad, you can then go back to a new revived capitalism. That is a pipe dream. Whether it would have worked in the 19th century, I don't know. But we're not in 19th century capitalism. And I guess the feeling with some people that they don't think capitalism is in decline. Well, we don't have perfect competition. Whether you have perfect competition ever is another question. But you don't even have limited perfect competition. Or what you have is very small numbers are firms in any one area, and very often you actually do have monopoly. And if you look at the supply chain for computers, you actually do have individual firms in odd corners of the world which are producing the only product for the computer. I mean, this has happened. The particular firm has strike, computer production stops in the world. Exactly. So, in other words, if you have creative destruction, and you can actually destroy production. It just can't be done today. This whole idea is a reactionary utopia, just as the policy of Thatcher was a reactionary utopia. It couldn't work, and it didn't work. And what came to being was something which she had no idea of what she was doing. In the same way, so that is not it actually isn't an option. The fact that they're talking about it at all, it's either because they have no understanding of what's going on, or because they simply want to transfer the burden of the downturn onto the working class. I think that's what it amounts to. But, again, what that transfers it to is the question of class struggle. It's highly unlikely that they are able to do that, and that isn't the way the bourgeoisie is going at the moment. So I don't think that actually is open to them. What they are afraid of is a return to the 70s, which brings us back to the question of the rate of profit. When they switched to finance capital, and I don't think you can get away from it, the fact is quite true that all big firms have a finance capitalist aspect. That's absolutely true. That doesn't alter the fact that General Motors produces cars, and its primary action remains within cars. If it doesn't produce cars, it wouldn't be a finance company at all. It wouldn't be a company. Now, it's just actually sold its finance firm. Now, it's generally true that all big firms have to have a financial aspect. That's true. But it doesn't mean they just mixed up finance and industry. It means that a large-scale industrial firm is a large-scale industrial firm with a financial aspect, which is imposed on it because of the nature of capitalism today, which is dominated by finance capital, most particularly in Britain and the United States. It's obviously less true, and one could argue exactly what it means, but less true in France and Germany, most particularly Germany. It's less true of Japan. But that historically has been the case. Well, what it seems to me is, to go back to the point in terms of the change over in the 70s, it seems to me that the working class by that time, not just the students, working class by that time, had moved into the phase of militancy, in part because they were controlled previously by the generation of the war, fascism, and the depression, which were no longer controlled by. They were no longer controlled by Stalinism. And it was that which caused the bourgeoisie to switch. That's why they couldn't face the militancy. Now, you say the rate of profit declined. There's no question profit went down. Of course, there was this argument in this country precisely over that. But no one has proved empirically that it was due to the falling rate of profit, a rising organic composition of capital. But enough people have shown that, and there's a very recent book on this in Germany, have shown that, in fact, what I've just talked about, the change of conditions, demands for changing conditions of workers and rising wages, as a result of demands by workers, did lead to a drop in profit. Now you can argue, well, okay, that happened, and a declining rate of profit due to the rising organic composition of capital, but nobody's ever proved. All that's ever happened is people have simply asserted it as an absolute. Now, I'm not arguing there isn't a falling rate of profit, I'm just arguing that nobody's ever proved it, and it's been fetishized. And it isn't enough to talk about it. You have to be able to talk about the actual actions of workers over time, the changes in the relation. And secondly, when you're talking of that, you have to talk of what the surplus value actually is, not simply the rate of industrial profit, which is what you're talking about here. You have to talk about the whole flow of surplus value. In other words, the whole unproductive sector, which after all comes out of surplus value. You have to be able to add that up and put it over over constant variable capital. How are you going to do that? You have to add up advertising, the whole, and all the other aspects of unproductive capital, including the aspect of depreciation, which is actually more advertising than depreciation. How are you going to do that? It's perfectly possible to do it abstractly. Or you have a huge institute there to add it all up. Yes, but nobody's ever done that. So if you want to assert that, you're making a pure assertion, which may be or may not be. You simply have to make some kind of judgment. But most of what he's written just dogmatically assumes that. And that's what worries me, the simple dogmatism of some of the theory which we get. That anyway, as far as I can see, it's very hard to assert that, and I do think it does act as the limit, but as far as but further than that, I can't see it. So in the 70s, it seemed to me basically what happened was that the bourgeoisie reasserted itself and undid the Bretton Woods agreements effectively, because the major aspect of it, which is kind of unstated, was that they would go for growth and full employment. They just undid that and went for finance capital, which means that what they did was to shift surplus value out of industry into finance capital itself, and then re-establish the control of finance capital over industry. And by doing that, they were demanding
higher and higher returns to themselves, and so forced the whole series of conditions on industry which came to be. Anyway, the point of that is that what has now come about is a logical evolution from that period. Now, they're not going to go back to that period. They're not going to go back to a period of full employment. And as we know, in Britain, you have some like 50% unemployment. You know, if you add together the people on incapacity benefit with the unemployed, you have very high levels of unemployment, which have been maintained over time. And if you were to follow out what happened in the 20s, it's very similar. In the 20s, you had high levels of unemployment all throughout. Absolutely true. And, of course, Churchill and his idiocy went back to the gold standard, which depressed everything again. That's absolutely true. But it's very hard to talk really of a boom in this whole period. You talk about it in formal terms, but there's high levels of unemployment in the period since the 70s. Doesn't make it a boom period. It's a very special period we've actually been in. Apart from the odd downturns and so on. And of course, if you look at the United States, you want to look at that in this whole period, as far as I understand it, three quarters of the population have real wages which are below that of 73.4. So it's been, from that point of view, it's been pretty depressed all throughout. In fact, there was only a relatively short period since the 70s where you did have a relatively high rate of growth where productivity rose. Most people refer that to the introduction of computing, which took some time before it went right through. But apart from that, the actual rate of growth was low in this period. So in a certain sense, it does compare. It does compare to the previous period. But anyhow, why does the crisis occur? Because in the end, the crisis has to be a crisis, however one puts it, in terms of underconsumption or disproportionality or foreign rate of profit. It is going to be a crisis between the capitalist class and the working class, in other words, over surplus value, and therefore must involve not just the technical aspect, but a real social aspect. And that's in part what was happening in 1929. It had a lot to do with the taking of power in 1917 in Russia. You can't just ignore that. You didn't have the technical downturn. And similarly today, one has to look at the changing social aspects and why this is broken down in this particular way. But of course, you can see that once you begin to examine this history over the period. And you really do have to go over the history of the last 20, 30 years to understand it. Finally, there's a question. Would the ruling class prepare to go back, as I said, to 1970s? Well, they're not prepared to go back. If they're not prepared to go back, they will not permit a reflation of that kind. They will simply not do it. But if they're not going to do it, and they're dead scared of getting back to that, that means there's no way that they're going to reflate to that level. So in that sense, Obama will not do that. And if he will not do that, you will continue to have a low rate of growth, and he will not have control of what's actually happening within the American economy. Thanks.
Just before we go to Jack, I want to interject one thing just to clarify and to sound an optimistic note, because rethinking the question of the immigration, just want to go back, because what you saw in the United States, what you're seeing in the United States, is an attempt by the government and the ruling class to divide the workers on the immigration issue, and it isn't working. And in the last election, they brought it up, and it showed in poll after poll after poll that this was only an important question for 10 to 14% of the population. And in fact, as it came out, as it became a really key issue in the debates in the election period, why was that a key issue? Because CNN was highlighting its program by Lou Dobbs on immigration in order to increase the ratings. So for the very first time, you had the media dictating the terms of the debate in the election in order to increase their ratings and therefore their profits. And it was a false question. And what's really interesting, because even with the ICE raids, you're seeing people react against it, and it failed. So I think that's really an important thing to think. And even on this issue that you see Obama now introducing in the stimulus package, the issue of education and health, he's already now said that unemployment that all of the people that have just become unemployed will automatically get enrolled in Medicaid without a means test, which is a backdoor way of getting universal health care. And of course, he's doing that too because, you know, on the issue of women, most of the households now are headed by women, and so this is affecting women far worse than it is men. So if you only create construction-type jobs, this is not going to solve the problem in society. So he is trying to do that at that level. But I think that the real key there is that so far, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, after, you know, the downturn of the period, there has been nothing successful to divide the working class in the United States. The immigration issue hasn't worked. Even if you go back 5 years when you had the division within the trade union movement between Change to Win and the AFL-CIO, that's had no effect whatsoever at the grassroots level. Workers, you know, you have the anomaly in Los Angeles, which has one of the largest labor councils in the country, and the head of it is a woman who is the international vice president of Unite Here, which is part of the Change to Win coalition, and she heads the AFL-CIO Fed there. So it's just they're ignoring it in practice. And now you have another thing going on. Maybe Jack will get to it. But I'm just trying to say that even though there hasn't been a political response by the working class, and there is no real left in the United States, they have not succumbed to the repeated attempts by the ruling class to use that kind of division. It's just not working, and they're increasingly desperate. And that's why I think you saw on the debate over the bailout of the auto industry, it was really quite interesting because the Southern senators spoke it like it was, and they said that they wouldn't accept a bailout unless they rolled back all the labor agreements that went back a half a century. In other words, to completely wipe out the gains that not just the auto workers won, but they won for the rest of the class. And I really hope that Jack will introduce that because he knows that so well, what happened in the 1971 with the working class. So I'll let you go.
Well, there's a famous comment, wasn't it, by Walter Ruth, when he was negotiating the original agreement with the GM at Ford, and said, but you guys really want to go for National Health Service, not any of these medical benefits. And the company said, no, you can have these.
But they do.
Well, I'd like to say a few things about how might capitalism recover, presuming it doesn't permanently collapse. You know, if you look at the history of these restructurings I talked about since World War I, in each period, you find a deeper involvement of the state in the capitalist process and in supporting profits and capital accumulation. Right from the very beginning, right before World War II, or World War I, rather, through the Reagan program. And that's why I'd say I believe we're going to see a greater role of the state in different new forms, propping up capital. What might these look like? Well, we're going to see new forms of nationalization. Nationalization is going to have 20 different variety definitions. And you will see a deeper permanent state participation in the banking system. Come out of this permanent. The Federal Reserve Board will have more comprehensive powers instead of just providing for the commercial investment now banking system. I think it's going to provide for all kinds of systems and near banks, quasi banks. GMAC, of course, now declares itself a bank, GE Credit, and so forth. The idea of a bank is going to be spread. Further, and it's going to be more regulated by the Federal Reserve System. There's going to have to be some sort of new retirement system. The post-war retirement system has been dismantled almost. That was a whole objective of Reaganomics and been going on for quite some time, undermining not only just Social Security, but the private pension, 401k. None of those provide anywhere near, even altogether, retirement for folks. The typical 401k only has $18,000 in it. So 65 years old, you know, you don't have a true union pension anymore. 100,000 real union pensions have been eliminated, and Social Security never did provide for more than one third. So you got 77 million baby boomers about to retire, and they got virtually nothing. I think you'll see a consolidation. You'll see a consolidation of Social Security, 401k, and the pension system, some kind of new health care. You already pointed to the direction. What you described was the S-CHIP program, Medicaid S-CHIP. They're going to try to introduce something along those lines. And I think you're going to see a new kind of corporatist relationship between the unions and the state, even a tighter relationship than we see now. They're going to shift the bad assets to the public balance sheet. That's going to happen next week with the aggregate bank. They're going to monetize all future debt that they're going to have to throw at the system. Monetize is this quantitative easing kind of thing that we're talking about. And Hillel's right. As long as prices are falling, they can monetize to their, you know, as long as they want. The key difficulty is going to be if and when there is a recovery somewhere else in the world, Europe or something, okay, then all these investors, the central banks around the world who have been buying treasuries are going to run for the hills and dump the treasuries. They're going to dump the price of treasuries, and the bubble that exists in treasuries now is going to happen. It's going to be like a subprime. They're very similar. That bubble will burst. Implications for that, for the dollar and so forth, are yet to be received. But they're going to have a very difficult time managing that transition, where they then try to sop up all the excess trillions of dollars they've thrown at the system to save it. That's going to be a real, real test period, I think. When I talk about the financial crisis and its role, it's extremely important. Finance capital is extremely important because with each financial instability event, they have to throw more money at it to bail it out and contain it. But it creates the conditions for the next instability event. We've seen this happen ever since the 1980s, and it's getting worse and worse. So the financial system is increasingly unstable. Now, that's not an original idea. You know, there's this economist Minsky who's been talking about this for some time. He died in the 90s. But I think what he misses is that there is a similar fragility developing in the non-financial system. And when both of them break, and they have to do with the income shift going on, when both of them break at the same time like they have recently, then you have a deeper downturn and a faster downturn. And that's exactly what we see right now. And it's the interaction between those that I think is really key, the financial instability and the real instability. And it's not a question of switching. I'm going to have to disagree with it. I don't think they switched to finance capital, but I do think finance capital grew in terms of its relative weight in the system. It's not a switch from this to that. It's they're still coexisting. But there's a greater relevance of finance capital because it's so much more profitable. There's no cost of goods, no cost of sales. You've got price inflation in each of the booms. As long as you move from bubble to bubble, you're going to make more and more money. But I do believe that that process of the relative shift to finance capital causes risks for the accumulation of investment on the non-financial side. I think it has an impact on it that we haven't really looked at, making the non-financial side more unstable as well. And it's the relationship between the two here, the dialectical relationship, that is the key. It's not one or the other. So you've got to understand how the two interplay and interact with each other in the whole general profit system, you might say. And that's the fundamental of what's new and what's different, I think. Last comment on similarities, differences with the 30s, the Depression. There are some, you know, dramatic similarities. There are some basic differences. Both were precipitated by a financial bubble, and that bubble bust. Both had to do with household balance sheets collapsing. People aren't aware, but as an economic historian, for example, in 1929, people had overextended on new homes. That was the peak of home construction and home mortgages. It was also the peak of auto purchases for the first time. And when the crisis broke, auto loans at that time, for example, if you missed one payment, first of all, they only financed for 1 year. And if you missed one payment, it was repossessed. And it was repossessed, and you lost all the money you had paid down and paid into it as well. You got nothing back. They didn't sell it and pay you off. you lost everything. So when these markets, credit markets collapsed, the working class, middle class were buying these cars, really took it in the ear, as well as losing jobs. The farmers took it in the ear. And the small businesses, those were the ones who really got hurt in the Depression. The big companies didn't get hurt that bad. They survived. Very few big companies actually defaulted, like the IBM and stuff like that, General Motors. So that was another major difference between them. And the banks hoarded. They hoarded money. They wouldn't loan money like they're doing now, for the same reasons that they're hoarding it, do it now. And housing prices fell for 6 years. 6 years. It wasn't until 1935 that they were able to stabilize the collapse in housing prices, 6 years later. And that was because of certain institutions that they introduced. So there's many similarities, but there's many differences. And that's why I say my idea of epic recession identifies the similarities, and there are similarities, but there are differences that aren't as extreme yet. It could grow to that in this current downturn. It's a hybrid. It's got characteristics of both. And I really think it's useful to understand how you transition from a recession to a depression. Bourgeois economists don't want to deal with that. First of all, they didn't believe depressions would ever happen again, so they weren't interested in the subject. But they're interested in it now. Okay? But to say recessions and depressions and one or the other, and there's no transition, our analysis is wrong, because it doesn't go right to a depression. There is a process and a transition phase that goes on in a depression before you get a bona fide depression. And that's what we should analyze, and we should analyze it quantitatively. Impressions are not very useful to really understanding scientifically what's going on if you've got data. If you don't have data, well then conceptual speculation is okay, but wherever the data is there, it's absolutely necessary that we try to understand the data.
Did you want to come back?
Yes.
Okay, and then we have the last round. It's now 10 to 5. We're going to, 5, presumably.
I re-emphasize the lack of analogy, actually, between the 1930s depression and now, because I think that's fundamental. Otherwise, you just rest on superficial similarities between, and you do not understand what is the specific nature of both the 1930s and today. I repeat, yes, in the United States, there was a boom-bust business cycle that could have been actually solved, if it wasn't for other factors, could have been solved in the usual way, boom bust cycles in the United States, and there have been three major boom bust cycles before 1914 in the United States, and they had been resolved without intervention from the government. In fact, the Federal Reserve didn't even exist until 1913. And you have to make a distinction between that and the crisis in the rest of Europe. Because otherwise, you start falling apart, you start having silly discussions and do not understand anything about what's either happening today or the 1930s. I'll give you an example. Most people don't realise that in Britain, during the 1930s, there was a boom in Britain. Right? If you were lucky enough not to be in the export industries or an export-related industries, in which case your job collapsed or your whole industry just disappeared, you actually experienced a boom. 70% of the housing stock in London was built by private means, during the Depression. That sounds to me like a thing. The first time British workers started eating oranges or bananas, all this exotic stuff that is nothing, during the Depression, because commodity prices collapsed, you had an imperial preference system, and that fueled a boom in this country. You can see it in Orwell. Orwell just picks up the worst bits, doesn't ever look at what's going on around London, infrastructural projects, etc. Going to the cinema, go around and see, when you see an Odeon sign, look at when it's built. 1930s, massive expansion in entertainment. And if you don't understand the nature of crisis, I reiterate that in Europe, The crisis was not a systemic crisis of capital. It was an unresolved crisis of the First World War. I'm not trying to excuse capital. I know the First World War was in many ways the product of it. It wasn't because of the declining rate of profit or something organic within capitalism. And you have to make the distinctions, because otherwise, if you abstract everything, then everything becomes related to everything, and nothing means anything, which is, you know, what most of the discussion amongst the left ends up being. Just on the question of, also leads in all sorts of proliferation of terms that I'm hearing, such as privatization of government. It's a silly term. There is no privatization of government. The state has always been privatized in the sense that it's there to help the capitalist and to sort out problems. When the state in this country, 1946, nationalized coal, they didn't do it, right, as a socialist measure, so the working class could have coal. They did it because they identified coal and the coal industry as absolutely key to the recovery of British industry. It was a capitalist measure. It was an entirely private interests that were involved in that. It was about capitalism. And what's going on today is exactly the same. Let's not invent all sorts of things, because then the debate becomes scrambled and we do not know what we're talking about and we cannot relate to each other. Despite being very gloomy about the crisis, I do not believe that there is going to be a collapse. I'm not one of those Suzanne Buchan-Thierry caprice at all. I think that we're actually going towards war, because there's more than one way of resolving a crisis. And, you know, past history, at least history of the last 100 years, tends to suggest that that is going to be the case. And in that context, we should see what's going on in Britain with the workers, etc. You try and make all sorts of excuses, but the very fact is that the workers in this country are very reactionary, totally imperialistic, and totally subjected to the ideology of their ruling class. That is the reality. That is the reality of the system. And the reason why, American workers, who are also very patriotic, but, you know, so they will go to war. In this country, you can butcher 700,000 workers, as it happened in the First World War, and nothing happened. There is no radicalization. Quite an extraordinary event. In America, they go to war also. They, you know, follow their flag. But after 6 months, they get tired of it, and they become anti-capitalist. You know, they don't want anything to do with it. That's why you're not seeing this, what you're seeing in Britain. That's why you're not seeing it in the United States, because there, the bourgeoisie, the state, doesn't have the hold that it has here. American workers are very, very patriotic for a while. For a while. And then it falls apart and they start bitching about everything. That's why in America you have a radical tradition. We have no radical tradition. You cannot name a single radical in this country equivalent to Chomsky, or of the dozens of people there are in the United States who are anti-capitalist, who are anti-imperialist. We have not a single one. Pilger, an Australian. Galloway, a Catholic, strange Catholic, you know, who opens his mouth and says, apart from that, we have it. You have to admit, your class, right, the British working class are deadbeat imperialists. And that they are cleverer. They are cleverer than you, because they have realised that this is the bottom line, and they have taken their position, which is British jobs for British workers. That's their way out. They are going to support... Yes, I'm generalising. This is what Marxists do. It's only if your generalisation is objective. What will they do? They will do what they've always done. Support their ruling class to smash another ruling class to solve the crisis. And that's why we're going to get war. We won't have socialism out of this. The workers are not going to come and build Soviet. They're going to try and smash somebody else, make somebody else pay for it. And that's why we're going to have war. Now, out of the debris of that, we will see if we can get socialism or not. But that's where we're going. And that's why it's extremely important to define our time. Because if this is a recession, then we have one strategic outlook. And if this is, in fact, a systemic crisis of capitalism, a real depression, it means a very different strategic outlook for socialism. In other words, our relationship with politics is very different from a recession. I'd say this very, very seriously, because if we are going through a period of war, we need to arm ourselves ideologically. First, we need to find out what's going on. Secondly, arm ourselves in ideology, ideologically, to meet the kind of ideological tsunami that is going to come towards us with economic nationalism, with situation of war.
Okay, well, I want to thank Sisa for waking us all up for this final round. Very good. Paul's waiting to speak. Who else wants to speak? Anyone? And then I suppose everyone can ask you who we're going to go to war with.
I don't know, but, you know, we'll find somebody.
Floor is yours.
Yeah, it's the question of consciousness. And, I don't think you can blame British workers.
I'm not blaming. I'm just stating the fact.
Any more than you can blame bankers for being personifications of a parasitic form of capital.
I didn't use the word parasite. In fact, I'm against the word parasite and talked against it. So don't ascribe things to have, that I haven't said. I don't have not talked emotionally. It's just impersonal forces.
The question is how to explain these sorts of consciousness. And one line of inquiry might be that the influence of social democracy and Stalinism has been much greater within Britain than, say, in the United States. I mean, if you look at the programs of left-wing social democracy in the 1980s, it's only 20-odd years ago, it was basically protectionist. They called it the alternative economic strategy, and practically the whole of the British left went along with this uncritically. And of course, you had the British move to socialism, which was the Stalinist alternative. They had their version of the alternative economic strategy. So the political economy of British social democracy, British Stalinism, was protectionist. My mind, and that's going to be reflected through the trade unions in workers' consciousness. I mean, I'm glad the conception of an alternative has been raised by John, and also Susie mentioned that we threw in another world as possible with the kind of the slogan of the social forum, the anti-globalization movement that arose in the late 1990s. Another world is, of course, possible, but it's not going to be a world of people forming small cooperatives and sharing their vegetables, and growing and sharing their vegetables. The problem, it seems to me, is that all forms of alternatives to capitalism are conceived in the present moment, and there's a heavy ideological investment in this, that they're utopian. That all forms of alternatives are utopian, including the classical Marxist alternative. And I think that leads to certain levels of despair. And Hillel has written very well on despair in his article on political consciousness in Critique. And the level of that despair is that there is no alternative, there's no way of going to it. But there are other levels, obviously. There's a desperation which is growing within the ruling class about whether to keep the system going. And of course, there's a desperation of the left who are aware of an alternative, but are desperate about how to get there. I think, you know, one of the things that the projects of the left in the present is thinking creatively about how to contradict those forms of despair. And I would suggest, well, obviously, our debate here is one of the forms of contradiction, which is to have a lively understanding based on Marxist political economy of the present.
Matthew again.
I don't recognise the socialist picture of the British working class, because if you look back over history, that just simply isn't true. The British working class has a long history, many contradictions. You can say these things about particular sectors of workers at particular times, but you cannot say it in general. It's not possible. The interesting thing will be, what is the impact on a union like Unite, which contains many immigrant workers, contains many workers from all over the place, and many sections of the left and so on, of this dispute. What happens within that union?
Nothing. Unions are nothing.
It will.
Unions are nothing. They are nothing. They are service organisations that provide cheap insurance, some cheap holidays. Nothing. They have nothing. It's just an illusion. What about strikes? This strike actually is not organised by a union, I should say. The biggest strike movement that we've had, spontaneous, in 14 different places over a two-year, it's not organised by a union. Right? You should meditate on that.
What the debate is British working class are all imperialists, and they support all British
people.
Well,
they do, don't they?
Against the Iraq war, we didn't start it.
And we had,
unless the UN said it was okay.
Well, whatever, but it
is.
It is. No, that's the truth. 80% of people on that demonstration, right, or at that time in polls, they would support the war if it had a UN resolution. So they're quite willing to do the killing without with a UN.
Okay. All right. So, and just on add to that, we have at least, I don't even know the numbers, more than 15 million immigrant workers marching in the United States and saying they're no longer going to be passive objects but active subjects, and it changed the whole debate. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to take the question of war. Well, who's going to go to war? Especially may not have noticed, but the United States is at war. And
in two places,
and so is Britain, maybe in a minor way compared to the United States. But it actually...
You said it's bust. It can't do it.
Precisely. Precisely, and Susan seems to make the point that the Americans don't want to do it. Well, since they're already doing it, they're doing it. And it would seem that the majority are now against it, so they're obviously not going to go in for a third war. So that's it. And that's part of my overall thesis, that we are in a period of decline of capitalism. What has stabilized it? Social is right, it's war. War, imperialism, repression, as in fascism, Cold War, and social democracy. Those have been the things which have stabilized. The problem is that you now left, there's no Cold War, there's no Stalinism, is in effect no longer playing that role. In fact, it's really ceased except in special areas. Social democracy has ceased, welfare state is going down the drain. So you're only left with war, that is true. All you're left with is war. But who's going to fight? That's the question. You know, apparently, Sassoon is saying the British
will fight.
Is
that a rhetorical question?
No.
Or,
no.
Well, because you're imagining... Sorry.
Sassoon is saying the British will fight. Well, okay, the British will fight, but nobody else is going to fight, apparently. So maybe Britain will fight France or America or God knows what. But the Americans are not going to fight. No. The only country which counts in terms of fighting is America anyway. I mean, if Russia want to fight Ukraine, they fight Ukraine. Who cares? I mean, it'll have absolutely no impact on the world economic downturn. So the only country which really counts in these terms is the United States. So unless the U.S. college students are prepared to go to fight, which they are not prepared to, we are not going to get a world war. Now, it's at a subjective level, it's crazy, I have to say, and it obviously is not going to happen. But you look
I'm
at it
write
more
this down.
I can write it down. It won't happen. It won't happen. Now, but look at it objectively. What we've been witnessing is a period of Cold War, which was most successful in maintaining capitalism. But that was Cold War was crucial. Now, neither side, in fact, really wanted to drop bombs on the other because that would have destroyed the Cold War. You know, that makes sense at the time, and people at the top knew that. All right, you had a series of hot wars in between.
A lot.
22, or something like that.
Every year.
That's right, but after the 70s, I mean, the Vietnamese War was really it.
Yeah.
It's not an accident that you don't have a call up in the United States, a draft. So what are you left with? You're not really left with an alternative of war. Secondly, if you actually look at wars, okay, apart from the Cold War, what you're really talking about is more than anything else is historically imperialism in the First World War and the Second World War. Well, what kind of imperialism do we have now? It's not based on the same thing. It's based on finance capital effectively exporting capital. The British Navy is now useless anyway, in terms of conquering the rest of the world for the purpose. You know, capital has gone into China. It hasn't gone into China by conquering. And in my view, China is a semi-colony. But it's not a semi-colony in the same way as it was in 1920 or 1910. Or 1930 for that matter. So war isn't an issue at the moment. War, I agree, would end the depression or downturn, whatever you want to call it. But it can't happen. We've reached a certain limit for historical reasons, and for objective historical reasons, and for subjective reasons. Now, a number of people besides you, and we actually have an article in Critique, which I'm not in favour of printing myself because of the overall content of it, not the, the level of it, but the does argue that war is the solution, and that is where we are going to, that is where we are going to get to. So obviously, more than one person does hold this viewpoint. I understand that you are putting that it is a reasonable viewpoint to put forward, since it would appear that that is the solution. But it doesn't seem to me either objectively or subjectively real. In fact, it's crazy.
Can I come back to that one?
Yeah, okay, Werner wants to speak, and then he has
it. I'm a bit lost about the purpose of the conversation that we're having. On the one hand, we seem to say capitalism is disintegrated. War does not seem to be something on the cards for various reasons. Others say, yes, it might solve the problem. Fascism, Italy, or German Nazism has been tried, but might not go back to it. And it seems almost like the capitalist class is without alternative.
Yes.
But should we not talk about us? What are we doing? If the capitalist class is without alternative, I suppose it is possibly at its most dangerous. It becomes nihilistic. You kill for the sake of killing. What will we do? What is our alternative that we force upon capital, either against it or force it to a certain trajectory? How do we view the Greek students? How do we view what happened in France? How do we view what happens in the north of England? Is it really that the workers strike by themselves in nationalistic terms, or is it more important to save the union? What is our political alternative? How we say this is us, and how we stand up for it, and how we force the other side, as it were, to adjust to us, and rather than us adjusting to them. What do we do? If capital really has no alternative, then of course we can all go home and watch television, football matches tonight, and feel very happy about it. But a capitalist class without alternative, and I repeat myself, is at its most dangerous. It's nihilistic. It will kill. And that I think we should discuss. So in a sense, I'm a little bit lost about what we are discussing. The capitalist class without alternative is nothing to celebrate, because the alternative that ought to exist has to be ours.
Well done. Okay. Let me just get some. It's 5:10. What are we doing? Can we go to 5:30? Do people want to? Is 5:30 okay?
Yeah.
Can I just come back on this wall?
Yes. And then Tony, thank you. And anyone else? Yes. And John. All right.
Obviously, war is crazy because we imagine it. You know, are we going to go to war with the Americans? Well, obviously not. Are we going to beat up the French? Obviously not. But that's not how it happens. War, the First World War, happened in a very different way. It happened to start. It happened to start with a local war. You know, a backwoodman's war in the Boer War in Africa. Which suddenly became internationalised. It then went on in 1906, with, from 1905 to 1906, with the Japanese-Russo War, in a place nobody could even mention these days, electrified the whole situation in Europe and laid the basis of only a few years later of going to a war that nobody envisaged, nobody wanted, and everybody, in some mysterious way, was dragged into it. That's also what happened in the Second World War, remember. It started off with a war in Abyssinia because the Italians, nothing, you know, let them go and have their little war in Africa. Led to a destabilisation of the situation. Japan followed the same in Manchuria and added China, and suddenly we're in a situation where war is. Nobody wants war because everybody knows perfectly well what the consequences are. The trouble is, it doesn't work like that. People are dragged into war, into wars they don't want. Now, what happens if there is a war, for example, on the Russian, things fall apart in Russia, which is not an a totally crazy outlook, fall apart in Russia, and the Chinese, things fall apart in China, and have a war on the border for oil and gas resources. They've been in conflict all the time over it. It's exasperated by separatist movements in China. People get very, very nervy and suddenly we have a war. Do you think that the rest of the world can stand aloof from that situation? While Russia is at war on its eastern flank, do you think there's not going to be movements on the west? Suddenly people start taking positions. The countries of Eastern Europe use that opportunity to take positions against the Soviet against Russia. Suddenly we have an international war. Nobody expected, nobody wanted.
Okay, before Tony, do you mind? Jack wanted to answer the point on the war.
Other than talking about the war, first of all, yes, war has played a role, Cold War, real war. But, you know, if you look at the defense and war budget, even defined very broadly, it's about $1 trillion a year, which is about 8% of GDP. In and of itself, it contributes to the profit support and profit maximization of the system, but it's not the only force, not even the key force. In my book, The War at Home, about the economic class struggle in the U.S., $1 trillion a year has been shifted every year for the last 5 years as a result of deunionization, which was a set of conscious policies undertaken, holding down the minimum wage and other policies, lowering the wage by free trade and offshoring 8 million manufacturing jobs, create 50 million part-time and temporary workers who get two-thirds of the pay and no benefits, cut the pensions, cut the health care costs, reduce the coverage, privatize the public sector whenever, wherever possible, state and local government, even the military, everywhere. Displace capital with labor, displace labor with capital, and massive restructuring and redistribution of the tax system. This has shifted income. That's part of the class struggle. That has propped up profits by a big margin, greater than the defense industry, I would argue. And then you've got the shift to financialization, whatever you want to call it, which maximizes the profits of the finance sector. So it's a multi-strategy that was part of this restructuring that began in the late 70s and 80s across the board, no single cause. They went at it in every way, shape they can. And those different approaches are running out of steam, as they do every 3-4 decades. And now they have to restructure it again, if they can. They're scared, yes. They're panicked, some of them. They don't know exactly what to do. Some of them are formulating options and opportunities, and you're going to see these roll out. They'll test them under Obama. Some will stick, some won't stick. But they're forging a new restructuring here. You talked about it in one of your examples about the Medicare and so forth. Question is, will they be able to, at what cost, to regenerate the system? They've done it historically every time. I would not rule this out. But going to war, I think, is crazy. I agree with Hillel. There's no one to go to war with. They can't afford it anymore. And it doesn't produce enough to sustain the system, going to war. In other words, in terms of profit. So the whole war option is really out of the question. And I don't care if Russia invades Kiev tomorrow. The United States is not going to intervene in that situation. There's no way to What's more important to the United States? It's the foreign resources out there. You know, the minerals, the oil, and so forth. They could give a damn less about what happens to Ukraine. That's not going to happen. And Russia couldn't afford a war with the Ukraine either. They don't have the resources to fight a war with the Ukraine. And of course, the Ukrainians don't. You're not going to see any wars as a solution. You will see increased state intervention, but not in military means, because it's not good enough.
Okay.
I think I don't want to return back to the 30s or in the earlier decades, but there have been all kinds of assessments ahead of actual wars as to why, if you did any kind of balance sheet approach to this, the last thing you'd do is go to war. It's not the war. Because, you know, you've still got the logic of all kinds of tensions and competition and everything else. And quite often, way after the event, various diplomatic things would come out showing how basically it's more or less deliberately planned. How different countries would be lining up against each other. They'd watch out what their rivals are doing over here. They'd sponsor some dissident movement there or whatever it is, right, in order to make sure they're protecting their patch. I think even with the example of Russia and Georgia last year, that that didn't develop very far, because you had, you know, the US was in a bit of a mess already. You had, you know, but you had basically a mixture of opportunist politicians in Georgia. You had Israeli provocation and sort of all involved in the government of Georgia. But then when the incident happened, you know, it was probably a bit on the verge of, you know, how big do we want to make this? And then because of Russia's importance in delivering gas to Western Europe and everything, you know, there was a lot of backing down. But, you know, that's just an example of something like trivial and apparently stupid happening that could have been different had various other constellation forces been in place. So I think the, you know, even trying to do a rational thing of saying, you know, look, you really want to, you know, obliterate several countries, kill 35, 50 million people, you want to do this, that, and the other. You know, come on, guys, you know, how much money are you going to make out of that? You can't do that kind of calculation. And it's more a case of, you know, how the pressures on the individual countries and the major areas are right. That's what's going to be concerning for the rest of the sort of thing.
Right, and just, you know, on that point, the Gulf War was profitable. The United States made $20 million, I think, off of it. Not a lot, but the Iraq War was not. Okay, John.
Yeah, just a couple of points, because I'm presuming we're winding up now, aren't we?
Yeah.
Coming to the end. So just a couple of points. So first of all, on the working class in Britain, well, of course, it's quite right to look back at the 20th century and look at the working class in Britain and say it didn't carry out its historical mission. That's absolutely right. But I think what Marxism needs to do is first of all say why, and it's certainly not in the DNA. And it does strike me that as well as looking back and looking at pro-imperialist Labour parties and pro-imperialist TUCs, I mean, scratch my head, and you could say, dismiss things very easily, but out of World War One, I thought there was an incident called the Johnny George.
Oh, God,
well,
yes.
Okay, so, you know, you can, you know, half I'm an optimist. That's the whole point. And if we look at history and simply say we were defeated, everything's going to be rotten, we're going to go to war, quite frankly, I wouldn't go home and watch the TV and watch football. I'd put a bullet through my head. On the other hand, if I look back at history and I say, well, these things happened, and I look at the present and see that other things are possible, yes, in that sense, you can look at the Jolly George incident and you can say, well, it was a trade union dispute. It was merely over, wasn't it, union recognition and, how should I put it, what's it called?
Demarcation
dispute. On the other hand, in the context of a threatened war between Poland and Russia and Britain joining in on the side of Poland and the TUC coming out and threatening a general strike, well, one can sort of wash one's hand of it and say, oh, this was nothing. Or you can see the potential. It does strike me, when we look at the ruling class, maybe they see more than some left-wingers. In that sense, what they saw was the potential of the working class, which is always surely innate, of changing from being a pro-imperialist working class to being its opposite. And if we didn't recognise that things can become their opposite, then yes, we ought to despair. But precisely, I agree with Matthew, when we look at this dispute, we can either see the completely negative side of it, this is just nationalism, or we can see seeds of its opposite. Of course it's nationalist, of course it's reactionary, but the fact that these workers are responding to something means it can be turned into its opposite. You know, workers are at one moment talking about Irish people in a sort of racial nationalist sense, then can be united with Irish workers in forming a trade union. That's just a historical fact. That doesn't mean it's automatic, and I agree with the comment here. You know, the role of left-wingers also matters, because if we go up, for example, up north, and simply go outside their dispute and say, you're a load of reactionary sods, you're all BNP, we're not going to get a hearing, right? That doesn't mean automatically people are going to listen to us, but at least we ought to go in that sense with the perspective that the working class can be one to act in its own interest, because that's actually what we're talking about. The working class has got no interest in a war, I would suppose, right? Therefore, workers will be prepared to listen to those saying, how do we get out of a war? Which I agree with you, is one possibility. I don't think it's a likelihood,
but it quite clearly is a possibility. Just last point, Susie. Cecil says that no one envisaged World War I. Well, I don't think anyone envisaged World War I with a capital WW with a one after it. That's certainly true. But, you know, if you look at the late writings of Karl Marx, if you look at the writings of Friedrich Engels, they talked about a European war. They talked about 20 million dead. They talked about the fall of the dynasties in Europe, and they wanted to stop it, right? But they also talked about the inevitability of the Russian Revolution. So in that sense, I don't really buy into your idea that there's just contingency. Of course, you're quite right. But if you look at World War One, you know, who was going to, I can't remember the guy's name who shot the pistol that killed the Grand Duke and all the rest of it. That's purely accident. But the idea of World War One being purely accidental, I disagree with. Well, okay, that's the impression I got from you about the Boer War, sort of bungling into the Boer War, bungling into the First World War, etc.
Precursors.
Okay, precursors. There's something in the system. There's also something in the working class that says it's anti-war. And in the same way, you can look at the 1.5 million in Trafalgar Square, and you can dismiss them as being UN groupies in that sense, or you can say, what a squandered opportunity that was to turn them into something more. It's how you look at things. And what is the role of the subjective in this, and what's the role of organisation? Again, I come back to these two comments earlier. Absolutely right. You know, we're part of the answer. And if we're not part of the answer, then quite frankly, we're part of the problem.
Okay. Before that, I would say that it was the emergence of the Soviet and the failed Russian Revolution of 1905, which is as much as anything precipitated the build-up to World War One, because it was the appearance of the actuality of the revolution on the scene that scared the ruling classes into intensifying their alliances.
It's not in the cabinet documents.
No, of course not. Okay.
Just one short comment. Everybody seems to agree that we're living in a period of great uncertainty. We don't know where things are going. And it's precisely for that reason, I think, that one should work with certainty when certain things are. Whether the definition of a period of uncertainty is, in fact, it is uncertain. One can't say with certainty it's something good about it.
All right, so what do we want to do now? Anybody else want to finish?
Can I? Well, I'd like to take up what Vern is saying. He said, since there isn't any obvious strategy for the ruling class, which I think is true, because in my view, the last strategy was finance capital, and with everything that's gone with it, that's been exploded. And it's hard to see what the alternative is, and it's hard to see the ruling class has found an alternative. And I don't think it is true that capitalism always can get its way out of a crisis. I don't think that's true. I think it's perfectly possible that the crisis, as it were, will continue, or if we want to, there'll be a slow upturn, or weak upturn. That's what's been predicted very, very widely. In a sense, then, the crisis will actually continue. Okay, now, what Werner says is, well, in that case, the ruling class is very dangerous. Well, it certainly was true of the period between the wars, which to a degree is the comparison. On the other hand, the ruling class knows there is no left. It's not going to be overthrown, so why should they be dangerous? Why should they actually do anything about it? I think at the moment, I'm listening to the BBC, they are worried. I mean, the BBC was talking of, I was quite surprised just a few days ago, of a possible war against internal terrorists who are not Islamic. So obviously, it's already been thought of, and your point is there, that there is that possibility. But at the moment, precisely for the reasons John's talking about, there is no left. What do they have to worry about? At the moment, they have to worry about anything. Let's say in terms of being overthrown. They have much more to worry about their own profits than about being overthrown. So I don't think at this point they are dangerous. When the working class begins to act, when there actually is a left-wing party, of course they will be. Perhaps your argument is that it will develop. And I do think it will. I mean, we have to ask, why has there been no left? And in effect, I was trying to give his answer all along. And basically, in my view, because the objective conditions for a left weren't there, And fundamental to that was Stalinism. It was Stalinism which actually held it back and prevented it. And that has come to an end. Now, you can say, well, why, since Stalinism has largely come to an end, it's hard to call China Stalinist, or you might want to call it something like that, or the Stalinist party for the capitalist class or something. But in general, I think Stalinism has come to an end. Because, of course, it did, talking of vampires, act as a vampire in relation to the left and the working class. It's not there. But logically, we now have an objective and subjective possibility of the building up of a party and the possibility of the class coming to being. The fact that it's not there doesn't mean it won't come into being. And unfortunately, I think Cecile is just looking at individual expressions by workers. The class is different from the workers. Well, I think we all agree with that as Marxists. And the logic of the position, it does seem to me, that we're more likely now to begin to get the formation of the class, whatever the subjective views are of certain elements of the class which go back to imperialism, which are very obvious. That, it does seem to me, is an inevitable process, to use a word some people don't like, but which I do like. I do think we are going to move through a position where the class will begin to express itself, even if it clashes with certain people or leaders or trade unions or whatever. And inevitably, we are going to get the formation of Marxist party or parties. And I think that's what we should be doing, if you ask. I think presumably that's what we're referring to. The form of it, I don't know. Of course, we've tried and failed, but we have to find a way forward. I think that's the only way we can possibly go. That's one reason, to just end, why, of course, we're having this discussion now. And I'm very glad that we've been able to hold the meeting and have different viewpoints, which was our intention, and have a debate around it, because there obviously isn't one viewpoint, and there won't be one viewpoint, and we have to be able to talk our way through these things. And we intend to take the recording of it and actually write up it, having been edited and printed and critiqued. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to
ask you for a very quick rejoinder.
Go. I think, Werner, is it? Yeah. You've said the most important thing there in the whole meeting, your comments, because, it's critical not only to understand the fundamental dynamics of where we are today, what's the nature of the crisis of the economic fundamental view, but you need to understand what are the options open to your opponents. We had to say, go into collective bargaining, bargaining contracts, and you got to know for each clause two or three responses that management's going to have if you want to deal with it in the market and have your own two or three responses. Each one, it's got to be in your pocket. You got to know where they're coming, likely to come from and go. In addition to that, though, you got to have some understanding of where the hell you want to go. Not just understand them, but where do you want to go? And there's such a lack of that discussion going on now, especially in the United States, where we have this terrible tradition of muckraking and empiricism and narrative and never getting down to anything below the superficial. Right? Oh, it's bad, and you describe the bad. Okay, now what the hell are you going to do about it? And no one has any theoretical ideas because they don't theoretically understand what's going on. Okay? And I see a real lack of that in the left. The capitalists, have raised the whole question of nationalization. Of course, it's capitalist nationalization from buying the first stock to who knows what. But they've opened the door, they even opened the door to discussion with socialists, you know? And where is the left discussing, okay, that's not nationalization, this is public nationalization in the service of the people. What are the alternatives that we are proposing? Because unless you have concrete alternatives and proposals of your own, no one's going to even bother listening to you. Because I go out and speak a lot on this, all, you know, radio shows, TV, and so forth, everywhere. And the first thing, and all kinds of people, it's the same wherever I go, it's first question, what the hell's going on? I don't understand. The second question is, what the hell are you going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? Those two things are the burning issue of the day. And the left isn't even addressing it. What left there is no left in the U.S. And so, after the review, another dumbass.
Okay, is that it? All right, just to end then, and it.
on, sounds like socialism, just to try to counter all this idiocy in the bourgeois press about what socialism is, where you have like Maureen Dowd saying that we're in socialism now in the New York Times and others too. They have no understanding. Any government intervention for them is socialism. And people write to me, actually, and say, please respond, we want to know what it is. So there's a real thirst there for it.